Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. I'm looking forward to learning a lot today as we continue to look forward towards the upcoming bird season, and we will have one if everybody crosses their fingers, closes their eyes, clicks their heels together. There's no place like the woods and the prairies, isn't there? Great guest in store for you, Mark Nissen of Classic Bird Hunts. More on him in just a few moments. But if you're a fan of ruffed grouse hunting or Arizona quail hunting, we'll delve into both of those, mainly the ruffed grouse. If you're just learning about all that stuff, I will pick his brain so you don't have to get a pencil and paper or somehow to make notes, because we got a great show in store for you here at the Upland Nation. We're outfitted by Cabela's, and in addition to talking grouse hunting strategy and tactics with an expert, we'll talk about public access and a suggestion for you. Yeah, I'll tell you where to go. Some hunting dog and dog handling strategies, care and feeding thereof, some tips and tactics. It's all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast. Don't know about you, but here in our state of Oregon, the comrade governor has restricted our movements to a great degree. And while I understand some of that, I don't understand most of that, and kind of probably violated the spirit of the edict, if not the actual literal interpretation of her stay home, stay healthy, blah, blah, yada, yada, yada kind of directive. Me and the lovely spouse and our two dogs went out to the middle of nowhere. I won't tell you where, because I might be going back there and I don't need anybody wearing a badge to come try and find me. But for 48 hours, we had no motors, no phones, and didn't even hear or see an airplane. That's how off the beaten path we were. And boy, oh boy, talk about therapy. It was the good stuff. Whether it's 48 hours or 48 minutes, you know what I'm talking about. Get out and enjoy it. Spend some time with your close family, anybody else you're allowed to socialize with, and then, of course, get out there and enjoy that magic that your dog works on you and everybody else. Hey, quick note, finally, after much ado, the Wing Shooting USA television program that I host and produce is now on Amazon Prime Video. So if you've got Amazon Prime and all you're doing is buying stuff with it, go to your smart TV or your whatever those things are you plug into your old dumb TV and watch Wing Shooting USA. Sure would appreciate that, and so would my sponsors. So thank you in advance for doing that. And in the meanwhile, let's talk bird hunting and bird dogs after this brief commercial message. Starting with Sage and Breaker, gun care products crafted at the highest caliber. My good friend Fred Bohm assures me that their pick and brush kits, which are very popular and sold out, are being assembled once again. Beautiful, beautiful workmanship on not just the tools, but the carrying cases. Lots of waxed cotton, looking beautiful, well-tailored stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. Sign up for the mailing list so that when those new products are available again and they got more on the horizon, you will get them. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. And Dogtra.com is where you learn more about my favorite training collars, the TNB Dual. It is all about tone and beep, get it, TNB, and the flexibility to run two collars with one hand, no toggling back and forth. All the buttons are right there for you to look at, for you to feel. You don't have to toggle. Oh, I'm so excited to talk about something that I certainly need to learn more about, and that is rough grouse hunting. Our guest this week on the Upland Nation podcast from the Cabela's podcast studio is Mark Nissen. His company is called Classic Bird Hunts. He hunts rough grouse in Wisconsin for part of the year, and then Arizona quail for part of the year. We're going to focus on rough grouse this time around. Mark's got all sorts of credentials, including the Orvis endorsed Wing Shooting Guide of the Year for 2018. His website address, Classic Bird hunts.com. Grew up in the North Woods, Wisconsin, been chasing those critters up there for going on 50 years, guiding for 40 of those. Mark, I don't know, I could go on and on and on about all that stuff, but tell me what you love most about what you do out there.
Well, Scott, it's great to be with you. And the first thing we love about the grouse hunting is probably no different than hunting any other upland bird. It's spending time outside with your dogs and being part of the hunt.
Well, you and I are going to get along great because that's exactly how I feel about it. You are a little bit different than many, though. You're running a whole string of Brittany's, I think. Now, how'd you end up there?
Well, it started in high school. I grew up with golden retrievers, and that's what I cut my teeth hunting grouse and woodcock on. And our family ones, they were great at it. And then I hunted behind my first pointing dog was a Brittany when I was in high school and fell in love with that whole game and just became passionate about it from then on.
They look to be, from the images I've seen on your website, they look to be, I guess I'll call them, I'll call it a field-bred coat, if you will. You work hard at that, or do you use artificial means to get that coat down?
No, I'd say we have roughly 14 Brittany's on staff at any one time. And most of them are bred. My mom does does Brittany breeding, so we get almost all our dogs through her. We have picked up a few. We've adopted a few and rescued a few and have bought a couple over the years from other areas. But we breed specifically to keep, as part of the breeding program, a little shorter-haired dog and not the long, fluffy hair that's a little harder to manage. But we do have a couple that we trim up every year too. So
I can imagine at the end of a day, you have plenty of other things to worry about besides digging burrs and sticks and who knows what else, the occasional woodcock stuck in the feathering of some of those dogs. Yeah. Tell me, because we're all dog guys around here. For you, on a guide string like that, you know, the constant Facebook discussions are about what is a finished dog. And there are people who refuse to work with a dog that isn't steady to wing shot, fall, and atomic blast. For you, how do you define a well-developed dog in your string?
We call, we separate them kind of from the B team and the A team. And virtually all our dogs are on the A team by the end of their first fall season. And we're not concerned about being steady to wing and shot. It's having control over the dog, them keeping a range and responding. Those are more important factors to us. There is the safety issue of course, being steady to wing a shot. And, we chat with all our hunters beforehand so they know exactly what's going on and what they can expect. And we've had no accidents over the, knock on wood, over my 40 years of serious guiding. So,
well, you mentioned two things that I'm a little bit more interested in. And the first is that safety talk. I don't want you to give it to me because that's kind of my job all the time on my hunts. but if there's anything in there that you think works exceedingly well, I would gladly steal it from you.
Well, the most important thing we tell folks is that unless there's a bird in the air, that safety doesn't come off. Period. If we hear that safety clicking off as you're going to a point, you're going to get reprimanded for it. And if it happens again, the hunt's going to be over. We've had three instances in my 40 years of guiding where we had to boot people off of hunts. And it's been for taking unsafe shots, usually over my head.
Ooh.
And sometimes it's been within a few feet. And fortunately, like I said earlier, it's there's only been three times I had to kick people off, and we've never had any injuries, etc. So we knock on wood and consider ourselves fortunate about that. But we are sticklers about safety. We remind people early and often.
Yeah, as it should be, and more power to you. You're a very lucky guy, and so are your dogs, by the way, but you know that. The other thing you mentioned already that I'm quite interested in, because I'm a Western hunter. You know, my dog is a 300-yard dog on a bad day and a 600-yard dog on a good day. But that's okay in the prairies and the desert. What's a comfortable range for your Britneys in the grouse woods?
I look at 100 yards to from side to side, and we don't want them going out front much more than 30 or 40 yards.
Yeah.
Most of our hunting is along trails, fire lanes, and roads. We do have, you know, some covers that we have to brush for. But the grouse relate to the edge. So most of our hunting is along trails, long edges of the field, etc. And with plenty of dogs, if you know, if they go in 100 yards or even more, it's not a huge deal to the side. Those are birds that, you know, if you're hunting with a flushing dog and you try to keep them within the 40 yards range or whatever, you've got birds out there farther that the pointing dog's going to find and hold. So that's our basic strategy as we go. We don't want them more than 30 yards up the trail at any one time, and have them quartering back and forth deeper to the sides.
When you're hunting in Wisconsin or anywhere else for that matter for rough grouse, can you give us a feel for what the ideal terrain and cover quality is like? What kind of plants and that sort of thing do you like?
Yeah, it's kind of broken down into time of the year. Early in the year, the grouse are feeding in northern Wisconsin, at least, mostly on berries and mushrooms. And as it gets towards mid-season, they turn to more greens like clover and strawberry and aspen leaves. And when you get towards the end of the season, they're feeding more out of trees. Ironwood trees are the big are a big key in our neck of the woods. You know, the catkins up of ironwood trees, if you can find ironwood orchards, you'll be in the chips from November through the end of the season in Wisconsin.
So interestingly, for much of the season, at least, it's all about stuff lower to the ground than the trees themselves. But there are trees of one sort or another in that habitat. Are they, you know, popple type covers or what else are you going to find in there?
Yeah, the cover is huge. I mean, you not only do you want to follow the food, which you do by working the edges and keying on the foods for the different periods of the season, but the grouse also relate to young aspen covers, which when I say young aspen, the prime for grouse would be roughly 5 to 15 years. Of age, and during that time you've got they're thick enough, I forgot what the exact amount of poles or trunks per square acre are prime for rough grouse, but it's in that 5 to 15 inch age year range. Mm-hmm. And if you throw some evergreens in the mix and some creek bottoms and some tag alders and you have a field edge or a trail nearby, we're almost always going to find birds.
If you've seen the one television episode we made of a grouse hunt, we were very lucky back then because we were invited by the Rough Grouse Society to their national hunt and had some great guides and some great friends. You know that I'm not the smartest, I'm not the smartest in anything, but grouse hunting is probably right there at the bottom of the list of smartness. If I was going to develop a strategy, Mark, or I'm your client for today, where are we going to start and what are we going to do in terms of strategy?
Okay, so we'll start out, and usually when we go out with the first timer, We'll try to keep it simple, keep it on flat terrain, stick to a trail. Pay attention to the dogs. Always be ready for a flush. They're so quick, and I think they top out at, or they get to 40 miles an hour faster than most game birds, if not all. Then you've got the trees to deal with too. You have to pretty much ignore the trees and point and shoot, poke and hope, and don't be afraid to let the lead fly.
Yeah, I have some trophy alder trunks in my den these days. Harvested a lot of that while I was out there, but also had a lot of fun. We got 1, 2, 6, 14 dogs on the ground. How many do you like to run at a time?
In the grouse woods, I like to run only one at a time.
Yeah.
We have that many dogs just because our hunting in Arizona is so much harder on dogs than it is in Wisconsin. But in Wisconsin, it just becomes, in my opinion, it's just too hard to keep track of everything if you've got, if I'm guiding two people and we have two guides down, two dogs down, it's just too much to keep track of. You might have a point on the left side of the trail and the point on the right side of the trail, and then you wind up losing both of them. So if everybody's concentrating on one dog, the dog goes on point. Usually we try to get one guy in a position where we think the bird's going to fly and have the other guy go in. We like to have them approach from the side of the dog. And that does several things. It helps take the dog out of the shooting equation. And it also lets the dog know where you are. So we're almost always hunting with more than one gun, especially when leaves are on the trees. The leaves are on the trees, it's almost impossible for a single gunner to kill a bird. It's a two-man operation.
Well,
we tell the clients not to stop behind the dog.
Yeah.
Pass the dog before you stop.
Are you letting them fly the bird given the choice, obviously, but we know they're going to fly wild quite often, but are you out there kicking birds up, or are they kicking them up?
No, the clients are kicking them up.
Yeah.
They'll walk past the dog will relocate, and that chase just keeps on going. The grouse don't have the reputation like a pheasant or a scaled quail of being a runner. But they can really move out, and when they know they're being pursued, they'll run a long distance.
When you're looking for your dogs, thinking they might be on point, is it because their bell stopped ringing, or because your handheld GPS receiver started beeping?
No, we run bells or beepers all the time. Especially since the wolves returned to northern Wisconsin back in the 70s. So, true or not, we feel better if predators know we're coming.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot safer too with the clients, especially ones that don't quite have the experience that they constantly know where the dog is. So that bell is either going constantly, where the beeper's going every 5 seconds when they're running, so there's no excuses for a low shot over the dog.
I love that. I've never quite thought about bells and beepers as a safety measure per se, but it sure makes a lot of sense. Do you when you're out there, like you said, dog goes on point, you're going to put one client alongside the dog. How far off the dog do you want them to start moving forward? In relation to that guy, where's the other guy? I know you wanted him flanking somewhere, but is he towards the opening? Is he thicker into the woods? How do you set up a pair of clients once you got a pointing dog?
Yeah, you do your best to guess where you think the grouse is going to fly to. And of course, the majority of the time you're wrong, but once in a while you get it right. They are the king of the game birds, and I don't know, the hardest to point, the hardest to kill, I think, to bring a bunch back. It's you kill two grouse in a day and you've had a good day, even on a good year. I mean, there's days when people appeal their limits of, which is five in Wisconsin, but if you've killed two, you've had a great day.
Are you seeing seeing the class everybody talks about, a cycle for a grouse population? Do you have seen that over 40 years of guiding, 50 years of hunting?
Totally. Yeah. I've kept very close records since 1977 of birds flushed, and this goes for woodcock and grouse. Birds flushed, shots fired, points, where the hunting took place, what dogs were hunting with, weather conditions, etc. So I've got this huge database to refer back to, which is kind of fun.
Oh, I bet, and very useful as well, I'm sure. But that the upshot of that for those of us who are relatively new in this world is there is a cycle. So at least part of the reason we're not seeing birds, maybe because there aren't any in that spot.
I lost track of your original question then, but we found a definite cycle here. The it's a 10-year cycle in Wisconsin, and the best years for us have always been years ending in 9 or 0. Huh. And now the grouse population overall has declined since the 70s when I first started keeping close track of the numbers. But the peak years still end in 9 and 0. We've only had one aberration, I believe, there in the that was in 2010. So we actually had more birds in 11 than we had in 10. But usually, 9 or 10 is the peak, and it falls off sharply after that. So 11 and 12 is usually the bottom, and 13 it gradually goes back to the peak again years ending 9 and 0.
Excellent. Good to know, and wish I could be out there with you this fall, because it sounds like it might actually be pretty good. But I'll be out somewhere, and so will everybody else. That's the whole point here, everybody. As you know, keep your fingers crossed and all of that jazz. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm your host, Scott Linden. That's Mark Nissen on the other end. ClassicBirdHunts.com is where you learn more about his guided hunting, all wild birds, rough grouse, and a few woodcock too, I bet, in Wisconsin, then also down Arizona way when it's too crappy to hunt in Wisconsin. You got that figured out. How long did it take for you to learn that trick?
Yeah, I had to hit about 40 before that kicked in.
You know,
and very happy it did.
I bet. Don't tell me exactly where you are down there, but it's probably in a town with a P in the first letter is P or the first letter is S. I'm not sure.
I have no problem telling you, because we have the exclusive rights to the largest private ranch in Arizona, and that's in Elgin, Arizona, which is right near those P and S cities that you're mentioning.
Yeah, I'll tell you that story off the air sometime, but I'll never forget when I first came here. I had the business newspaper, and I could, if I wanted to interview any of the big players here in town, I had to do it before the first snow flew, because by then they were all headed for Palm Springs in Arizona. I thought they were crazy. Now I think they were brilliant. Hey, hang on, Mark, for just a moment or two. I got to pay a couple bills, and then we're going to come back, because everybody knows right after this break, we talk about dog care and dog handling. We call it the Handle It segment. So just relax for a moment while I do the heavy lifting here, including talking about Dr. Tim's Performance dog food, my dog food of choice for all sorts of reasons. Maybe it will soon be yours as well. 30% discount on your first order. Just use the code UPLANDNATION. As I've told you before, Tim Hunt is a veterinarian who does all the homework, and he has added taurine to all of his formulas for the sporting dogs because he wants that taurine to get in there and work on the dog's functions, both organ functions and then muscular requirements. So taurine is a very important ingredient in Dr. Tim's performance dog foods, and he promises to exceed the average dog daily requirements of taurine. And also ESPAmerica.com, Electronic Shooters Protection America.com. I'll never forget interviewing somebody on a Field and Stream radio show a long time ago, and he said, "Can you make the volume a little higher? I shot my ears out." And I said, "What?" I had never heard of that before. And he told me, yes, hearing loss is cumulative. He, being a drill instructor teaching young recruits to shoot M1 carbines back in the day, that's how old he was, he simply made himself deaf. Don't you let it happen to you. Learn more about all the options at ESPAmerica.com. All right, that's our cue. Wake up, Mark Nissen. ClassicBirdHunts.com. Are you with me there?
Okay. I'm with you, Scott.
Good, because we're going to talk about young dogs in the Handle It segment here from the Cabela's podcast studio. Hey, for just a few more days, save up to 50% in the Cabela's Outdoor Authority sale. Learn more at Cabela's.com. Mark, I have been seeing so many Facebook posts these days about puppies, and well, I get calls, frantic calls once in a while from some folks saying, you know, my dog, he's almost 6 months old and he's not a non-slip retriever yet. And so I end up bringing expectations down in so many ways all the time. And I feel like a party pooper out there. But, you know, everybody has their own idea of what a dog should be doing at what age. But that early stuff, you know, you get your dog home and you start working on basic stuff. I think a lot of it is acquainting your apprentice bird dog with lots of different kinds of people and places, some of the grooming practices, doctoring stuff, looking their ears, looking their eyes, that sort of thing. And then maybe some crate training. I could go on and on. But here I have an expert with 14 Brittany dogs and a mom who's a breeder. Mark Nissen at Classic Bird Hunts, if you're bringing a new dog into the string and he's very, very young, what is one thing you think we might want to do or not do that maybe is not on our planning schedule yet?
Well, I've always looked at it from the point that you just want them to go out there and have a good time when they're a young dog. I'm fortunate to be in a situation where I always have a polished dog for them to go out with. So even when they're just a couple months old, they're chasing the other dogs around the woods and getting their feet wet. And, last year I trained two Brittany pups, and they were pointing woodcock consistently at 4.5 months, but as long as I'm touching on woodcock, there's no better wild training, wild bird for training dogs than the woodcock. They hold very well for points in there, in areas that are predictable. So we're fortunate to have that in front of us. But the main thing is you don't want to get them scared. You don't want to have them catching a bird, things that can mess up their progress.
Yeah, even those very young dogs. A lot of folks will tell me that their young dog is kind of startled or maybe even scared of the first live birds they encounter, especially if it's a pigeon or something like that that's just out in the yard and they're working with them. A lot of that is probably avoidable if you just introduce them right. Is that something you do?
You know, I think it's probably been 6 or 7 years since I've had to take dogs on pen-raised birds. They all get their start in the grouse and woodcock woods. And you know, I follow an experienced dog in, it's on point. Oftentimes the dog's only 3 feet from the woodcock, and you can bring in the puppy on a checkboard, and basically nothing but positive can happen from that.
Love it. You said something in there that I'm a little bit intrigued by, and I can guess as to some aspects of it, but from a pro guide perspective, if you want to put those young dogs into woodcock territory, why don't you define a little bit of the characteristic of that kind of place?
Sure. The woodcock will hang out in usually moister area than grouse. And younger aspen than grouse, often along stream beds, etc., tag alder stretches. And they also relate to north-south running roads. If you have a north-south running road and roughly a creek or a river that's also running generally north-south and with some young habitat, brushy habitat by it, it's almost a sure bet for finding woodcock. Woodcock migrate along river systems and creek systems, and they mistake roads and they're also nocturnal, so they fly at night, and they mistake the roads for rivers, so they wind up landing near the roads thinking they can get a meal there, and some of our best woodcock hunting is done right along gravel roads.
So I'm intrigued now. This is something I've never heard before about woodcock, and is it because they're generally flying from north to south and south to north, depending on the time of year, you think that is why they're relating to those geographic features?
Yeah, those would be migratory birds,
which
come through northern Wisconsin starting the end of September and go through the end of October.
Well, you learn something new every day. Thanks for being on the pod. No, we're not done. We're nowhere near done. So pour another drink, because that's the only way you can put up with me. That's Mark Nissen, Classic Bird Hunts. I'm Scott Linden, your host here at the Upland Nation podcast. All sorts of great information here. Mark, if you were going to help somebody train their rough grouse and woodcock dog, and it was a more mature dog than the puppies we talked about in our Handle It segment, what is the most important aspect of training that you would instill in a young dog that you think we probably may not do as often as we should?
That's a good question. I mean, the three things that I've always thought that you need to do is get your dog on birds, more birds, and even more birds. That's the theory that we work on. It's all about contacts. You know, I'm fortunate to be in a situation where I hunt wild birds 100 plus days a year, you know, all day long. So they're getting a lot of contacts and positive reinforcement, but they also have to know who's boss, and you combine that with getting them on birds, their natural instincts just kind of take over, and don't try to overtrain or yell too much. The dog's going to pick it up if you have patience and you don't mess them up.
You mentioned positive reinforcement. I'm a big believer, but you also mentioned letting the dog know who the boss is. Does that include electricity at any point in a dog's career?
Yes, it does. And it certainly doesn't take much if you've got a reasonably intelligent dog. And it's not only for training purposes. We run combination beeper shock collars on our dogs at all times. But for safety purposes too, you get a dog near a road. Well, we should start off by saying all our dogs are trained to come back by the beeper. So if I give a rapid beeper signal, that's going to bring the dog back. If they don't react to the beeper signal, it only takes one or two times to nick them, and they're coming back every time when you hit the beeper for them. So when you get close to a road and you get worried about them, you see a wolf in the distance or some danger out there, you can always beat them back, and it's a huge safety factor too.
You think that might be the most important command in your lexicon?
Oh, you know, I think you might be right there, Scott. For the most part, I just, once they've learned the game, I give them their head and let them go. Each dog will have a little different hunting style. So I try to pick covers that would suit their style. But after that, I kind of give them their head and let them go. And we follow the dogs, and they're telling us what to do. They're taking us hunting, not vice versa.
Yeah, I wrote a book along those lines. but that's another story. But you just said something that I'm intrigued with. You pick covers. You match dogs to covers. Dog styles to cover types, I guess, would be the best.
Yeah.
Just tell me. Give me an example of that. I'm curious now.
Okay, if we're going down, we're typically hunting trails in Wisconsin, and if I know that there's a little hole that always holds a half a dozen woodcock, and it's 150 yards off the trail, well, then I'll take my bigger running dog, and you know I know he's going to go out there and check that spot out for me. If we're in real super thick cover, and the birds are normally along the trail, then I'll use a closer running dog.
Okay. And with 14, you probably have a dog for every named cover in your territory. but I won't ask you for the latitude and longitude. The thing when I was out there, and I've actually probably hunted 6 or 8 days all told in Wisconsin for roughies and timber doodles. The closest we ever came to one was a big pile of steaming wolf poop on the ground. Have you had any closer encounters than that?
Yes. One pretty good story that happened preseason. I was training one dog. I had an experienced dog with me, and I had a cat pistol with me. The young dog, young pup, was maybe 4 or 5 months, and I was heading down a trail, and after we had left the vehicle and we were about a half a mile into the trail, we heard a wolf howl between the vehicle and us. And so I just kept shooting caps. I put both dogs on the leash, and I didn't really want to turn back towards the car where the wolf was, so I kept going down the trail. The trail happened to be a 2-mile-long trail that ran pretty straight. So we kept going down the trail. The wolf kept howling every 4 or 5 minutes, and it was directly behind us. We got to the end of the trail, and at this point I had to turn around, so just kept firing caps as we went back, and never heard the wolf howl again, but it was obvious that the wolf had trailed us, because the dogs would go nuts whenever they detect their scent across the trail. So he was basically following us for a couple of miles, and for whatever reason, gave up at just the right time.
Well, until that, it was kind of like a really scary horror story, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely was. The hair was up on the back of all three of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. And we all know of stories that didn't have such a happy ending, but we won't dwell on those. Hey, let's talk to a pro guide, Orvis endorsed wing shooting guide of the year, just a couple back. You're still celebrating probably, but when we show up for a guided trip with you, how do you prepare us for that? And I don't mean wear good broken in boots and don't forget to practice your shooting before you, but what is something that you would like us to have done or to bring with us that we probably forgot?
That's a good question. You touched on a couple of them. We've had more hunts ruined by people not having broken in boots than anything. And after that, it's about safety. I'm not sure what else to say besides that.
Well, you talked earlier about it, and I've got some taxidermied alder branches and trunks in my studio here. But is there some way we can practice shooting amongst the trees?
Yeah, you can go out to your local trap range and have your buddy cut off a couple of pine boughs and beat you across the face while you're trying to hit the bird.
Yeah,
might be a good way to practice.
Yeah, well, it didn't help me. Oh, that's so true, though. It really is. Not only are they obstructing your gun swing and your view of a bird, but they're also, like you said, poking you in the eye. And you got to get used to all of that. I guess there's no, you know, there is one way, actually, and it might help. I've talked in the past about an instructor I had who told me to shoot like a predator. In other words, just pretend you got blinders on and you're seeing nothing but that target. That kind of narrows your focus literally and figuratively. So
exactly. Ignore the trees. Yeah. Concentrate on the bird and follow through and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Over the years, our stats are, we call it 1 for 4. So you move 4 birds, 4 grouse, and you get a shot at 1 of the grouse. If you hit 1 out of every 4, you're doing better than average.
I believe
it. Which means you kill 1 out of every 16 birds that you move.
Wow. I'll never forget being struck. I also wrote an article for Rough Grouse magazine as a result of all of that. And whatever they were calling it back then, at least. Anyway, I was, until I'd done, 5 grouse hunts in 10 days, I didn't realize why you guys wear a lanyard that counts flushes and why you guys get so excited when you actually just hear a bird flying away in the distance. Now, do you count those as?
we do count those as flushes, yes. Back when I was younger, my clients used to say that I didn't hear any bird. And now that I'm 60 plus years old, they're hearing more flushes than I am. So yeah. That makes things, makes me look a little more honest.
Yeah. They, some guys have a good day when they heard 3 birds fly away. Oh, I love it. Well, if I was your client, and maybe someday I'll visit you, but probably down south instead of up there. How can, we're walking around together and there's a dog on the ground and maybe I got a buddy with me. How can I help you be the best guide out there? And I'm asking you because you are the best guide out there. What should I do? Should I just pay closer attention to you, or is there anything in particular that would be helpful for you to help me?
Well, first off, pay close attention to the dog, even closer attention than you paid to me. Always believe the dog before you believe me. When that dog goes on point, get there quickly and safely, and don't stop behind the dog. Once you get past the dog, you can stop, but don't stop unless you can swing your gun.
I think I wrote all those in that article.
You should be an ace grouse hunter.
Yeah, I just need a couple hundred more trips. That's it. But and just for the record, let's repeat that. Don't stop until you're confident you've got a pretty clear gun swing. Now, I would echo that, and so have you. We've learned that the hard way. How many hundreds of times?
Oh yeah, probably thousands of times. Yeah. And it's when you stop, you're liable to make the grouse flush because he's not exactly sure where you are anymore and gets nervous. So that's why we tell people don't stop until you can swing your gun. There's a chance the grouse to get up in a spot where you can't swing your gun. And it's just the way the game works.
Yep.
When a woodcock gets up, you have time to recover. They're a little slower flyer. But a grouse, you have to treat every bird like it's going to be a grouse because they're quicker and a lot cagier than the woodcock are.
Yeah, and so let's compare and contrast those two birds. I shot three or four woodcock all told in my career. None of them did what all the magazine articles say they're going to do and go straight up and then hover there waiting for you to get your gun to your shoulder. Do you ever see that?
Yeah, we do. We do. More when the leaves are on the trees, they can't actually see it happening because you can't see the bird because
sure.
The leaves are on the trees. Yeah, they're... Not only do they not do that, people, I talked about how they're a great bird for pointing dogs because they hold well, but they'll also run. I've seen them running, and it's quite hilarious to watch them do it. They kind of waddle real fast rather than run, but they will move out from under a point, too, and they will fly low. They will sometimes fly straight up and do like you talked about. They're also pretty unpredictable, but... slower. So we like to call the woodcock a knuckleball and the grouse a fastball. And
yeah.
You never know which one's coming.
Yeah.
So that adds to the excitement.
You know, and I've seen enough of them flying away to truly believe that a rough grouse does use the terrain and particularly the big tree trunks as obstacles to the shooters. Would you agree, disagree? You've seen it happen?
No, I totally agree. Yeah, it seems like, they're not the king for no reason. They invariably will put something between you and them. They'll also seem to, you can be on the flattest land ever and there'll be one little hill there and they'll invariably fly over that hill and just disappear before you can get a shot off. That happens a lot too.
Well, that's a chucker hunt for me. That they use the terrain as their what we use their pulling guard when we played football.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes. Lombardi sweep.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're dating each other.
Being from Wisconsin. Yes.
Okay. Okay, boys and girls. Vince Lombardi was a famous coach. In fact, he was the winning coach in the first Super Bowl, wasn't he? You should know
indeed.
That. Yeah.
The Lombardi Trophy.
Yeah.
Yes. It's still the Super Bowl Trophy. Yes.
That, in fact, they didn't even call it the Super Bowl the first year. But that's now we're going down a rabbit hole, and I promise never to do that. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Mark Nissen, Orvis endorsed wing shooting guide of the year 2018. I'm Scott Linden. I've never been anything of the year except older. All right, and I'm sorry to belabor the let's help everybody be a good guide client, but you're out there in the middle of freaking nowhere, and hopefully you haven't heard any wolves howl, and you got good dogs. There's almost always, I mean, what little guiding I've done, and certainly as a client I've done a lot more of that. What do they always forget to bring that you always have an extra one in your vest?
Ooh, well, I've always got the most important thing I carry is vet wrap, and that works for both the dogs and the clients. If they're getting blisters, we just whip the vet wrap out, wrap them back up, and away they go again. And as far as the dogs goes, they get caught in barbed wire, get a cut, you got that vet wrap ready to go on, and hold that slice in place.
I've never heard of it as a blister repair. I love the idea. I've got it with me all the time. I'm going to remember that.
Yeah. It saved guys a lot of things.
Well, that's cool. Now in the grouse woods, it's probably a little less critical, but overall and over the course of a 100-day season, dogs get tired. They get worn out for any number of reasons. How do you keep your dogs in shape and safe as you're heading into the season and then throughout the season? Is it diet? Is it conditioning? Is it secret potions that you can't tell us about?
Yeah, no, it's both diet and conditioning. I get all the dogs out for a run twice a day, and feed them and keep the grandkids from feeding them table scraps, and it should be good to go by the time the season opens. We're not fortunate, but we don't have a lot of bookings early in the season when the leaves are thick and the mosquitoes are out. So that's a good time to get the dogs into shape too, and get them back in the
program. Well, when you're running them twice a day out there, are we talking about a mile or are we talking about 15 miles?
No, we're just talking about a 15-minute run where they can cut it loose just to get it tuned up.
Excellent.
Having this many dogs, rarely do dogs have to run more than a couple hours a day. So.
Sure. So are you supplementing their diet during the season or during the day? For example, I have this product that I call it my dog energy bar, and I, in fact, sell it. But it's kind of like Red Bull for dogs, but it smells worse. Ever give your dogs anything like that during the day?
Nothing specific like that, but I'm going to have to look into that, Scott. But they do get small treats throughout the day.
We're getting towards the end of this, so I'm saving the best for last here. First of the last two questions for you, Orvis endorsed wing shooting guide of the year. You bring home some woodcock, or your customers take home some woodcock every year. Have you found a recipe that's actually edible?
Oh boy, not this question. Yes, yes. this is a good one. But the big thing about woodcock and having it taste good and not be gamey is don't freeze it. Don't freeze it and don't overcook it.
Yes.
We almost all do all our woodcock fresh. We grill it, keep it red inside. Put a rosemary garlic sauce on the top of it when we serve it, and people tell me they think they're eating the best tenderloin ever.
Well, you know, you hit on something. Every pro chef that I've ever asked about wild game, to a person, says there's about a minute of wiggle room in there, and if you exceed a minute of overcooking, then you got fish. You don't have game anymore.
That is so true. That is so true.
Well, that's good to know. And the other one is, and believe it or not, I get this question once a month from somebody. So be honest with us, be politic, be diplomatic. But I'm going out with you for a day of grouse hunting, and it's not just showing me where to go, and it's not providing the dogs. It's the whole, and you know, it's the entire experience, your knowledge. You probably fed me in one way or another. You were entertaining. Your conversation was scintillating. How much do we tip for a guide on a great day?
Most of our clients leave us a tip per guide between $50 and $100 per day. Mm-hmm. And there's some days that have been fantastic. And if you'd like to tip a little more, that's great. If you don't leave us a tip, that's fine too. But most folks leave us between $50 and $100.
Well, that's great to hear from somebody who's on the receiving end, because a lot of people agonize over that, and it kind of screws up the whole day. Have you ever seen that in a guy?
Not that it's screwed up their day, but you know, some guys will just ask me at the end of the day, and I'll tell them just what I told you, and that, you know, that's very cool that they do that. And we never expect a tip, and we always appreciate a tip. So it's not like you leave and you don't tip us, and we don't talk about you too much.
Maybe in
you're
this
still very welcome back. Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Buffett has a coconut telegraph, and the guides probably have the same thing. And you don't want to be mentioned in that one, do you? Well, it's you know, next time we'll talk quail in Arizona, which is a subject I think I got a magazine article coming out on something related. Anyway, I'm going to make a study of that sometime soon, and you will be part of that as well. Mark Nissen is the proprietor of Classic Bird Hunts. Find them at classicbirdhunts.com. Rough grouse early in the season, Arizona quail when the snow flies, Orvis endorsed wing shooting guide of the year. Mark, enjoyed every single minute of this. Thanks so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
It was great chatting with you, Scott, and look forward to doing it again.
All right, be safe out there. Thank you. Well, I sure learned a lot from Mark Nissen. I hope you did too. Some of those slap your forehead kind of bits of knowledge will come in handy this fall when I do promise you I will make a couple rough grouse hunts out my way. It won't include any woodcock. What I want to include right now, though, is a quick mention of Gunner Kennels. That's the kennels, the dog crates that we use here at the Upland Nation podcast and Wing Shooting USA, the TV show. For all sorts of reasons, the only 5-star rated crash safety dog crates on the market. They are engineered so that you will protect your dog investment as carefully and as readily as you protect your firearms investment. Never quite thought about it that way, but if you value your shotguns, you've got them in a good carry case, you ought to do the same for your dog. You need another incentive? Well, through April, free tie-down straps with every purchase. They also offer financing, so there is no excuse for protecting your valued hunting partner as much as you protect your firearms, your kids, and all that other good stuff you cherish. And make a note of this, dogtra.com. If you'd like to purchase any Dogtra product, including the T&B Dual or their Pathfinder GPS, use the code SLUN10 for 10% off. And of course, there's free shipping on anything over $200 as well. All of that is at dogtra.com. The thing I like most about their T&B Dual, single big black box on the collar itself. That horn on some of the other collars that is right between your dog's ears, no such thing. Your dog won't lose his hearing like my friend I told you about earlier, because the horn and all the beeping will be shooting down away from his ears. Oh, you'll still hear it. Believe me, you will still hear it. Dogtra.com. Learn more about all their products, including the T&B Dual, at dogtra.com. This land is your land and my land, and we own it, and luckily, most of the time, and more good news on that coming up, by the way. In fact, I'll tell you all about that right now. Looks like there's a move afoot in the federal government to open up millions more acres of wildlife refuge to hunting. Stay tuned for more on that from the Interior Department. But in the meanwhile, one that does offer hunting now is in the far southeastern corner of California, Sonny Bono Salton Sea National Wildlife Refuge. I won't tell you about the time I met Sonny. Great guy. Left us too soon, but the wildlife refuge named after him offers both waterfowling and pheasant hunting. If you're inclined and you are headed from Southern California to Arizona, you will be going right past the Salton Sea National Wildlife Refuge. Get your license, bring a good dog, be safe out there, and enjoy the Sonny Bono National Wildlife Refuge at Salton Sea. That land is your land as well. All right, I alluded to ESPAmerica.com, Electronic Shooters Protection, America.com, where I've learned so many lessons about hearing protection and how permanent hearing loss can be. You should too. Go to ESPAmerica.com and shop all the choices. And right now, unfortunately, my choice is to shut up and go away. I'm going to go train Flick a little bit more before it gets too dark out here. Maybe you're going to do the same thing. whatever else you do, please subscribe, rate, or review the Upland Nation podcast. It truly does help. Tell your friends. Check out our discussion at the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page or the Upland Nation Facebook page. Yeah, we may be kind of a little bit restricted in our movement this recent weeks, but we can still reacquaint ourselves with family and friends, and we can still spend some quality time with our dogs. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast. I wish you the best. Be safe out there. And remember, we will be hunting this fall. Keep your fingers crossed. Get ready for it now. Thanks again for listening.